Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special episode of the Product Breakfast Club podcast. And this is coming out over the Christmas break, where we're not going to be recording our normal, let's say, mainline episode, so you know, the main storyline. This is a completely standalone recording that I found from an event that myself and Jake ran June this year in Berlin, where it was a fireside chat all about the design sprint. So I interviewed Jake about the design sprint, and then the audience, we had an audience of about 40 people, the audience asked questions. Now, we were just going to leave this week blank and have no podcast, but when I listened back to this, I mean, it's very raw. We only had one recorder, so we didn't have two channels. It's at times hard to hear, but I think there was some really, really interesting information in this recording. So I decided, you know what, let's put it into the podcast. Every other episode is a ramble fest anyway. If this is the first thing that you're ever listening to of Product Breakfast Club, I would recommend maybe not starting with it. I would recommend maybe starting with episode 1 or episode 4, 5 or 6, because this is not really how the podcast sounds usually. This is, and I'm stealing a term from Tim Ferriss, this is an in-between-isode. So while we're chilling, I found some other audio that we're going to be able to use. So it's a 1.5-hour-ish interview, fireside chat with Jake and myself about the design sprint. I hope you enjoy it. Really great to hear so many people listening to the podcast right now. It's really amazing for us that people are enjoying it. That's all I have to say. I hope you have a really great holiday or had a really great holiday. See you in the first week or second week of January for the next mainline episode. Thank you very much. Welcome to our little fireside chat with Jake Knapp. So guys, I met Jake the first time, I think, in February this year.
Yeah,
I think,
that sounds right.
Approximately. Yeah. After a little bit of scheming and social engineering to get myself to meet Jake, I'm curious from your perspective how you think you're now in this room, how this all happened.
How do I think this happened? Like, I think it's really funny that you think you had any agency. I was engineering you to think that you were engineering me.
Oh my God. It's all been
an elaborate ruse. I just wanted to get here right now. And it was everything.
You
was
want to work at AJ and Smart. Is that it?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I was thinking JJ and Smart.
Okay. All right. But you don't get any like stake in the company and no salary.
Okay.
Great. I'm going to be sort of doing a brief interview with Jake for the next 30, 40 minutes. And then we'll open it up to the floor for questions. I'm sure that we'll be able to get everyone's questions if you want them. All right, Jake. So let's get started.
Okay.
How did you end up working at GV, or maybe even a step back at Google?
How much time would you like me to fill with this?
Let's do some like a quick fire from maybe like when you were like 16, maybe until.
Okay. So at 16, picture a nerd. That would be me in high school, really into school newspaper. I worked on the school newspaper, and we always had Apple computers growing up. So I grew up in the 80s, and they had computers in school. It was all Apple computers. So we had like Apple II and then like the Mac. And so like black screen with green text and then white screen with black text. And then anyway, there was a piece of software on the original Mac called HyperCard, and you could make basically simple software with it. You could lay stuff out, buttons and controls and text fields, and you could program how it worked. And I got super into that, made games. And so I was 16, I was still doing that. I was making games
from birth
on the computer.
Till 16.
From probably middle school. So probably 12 to 16.
Okay.
Yeah. At 16, just got an email address. You know, I knew one person who had an email address who's my friend, Ian. And
Ian,
if you're watching. Yeah. And Ian pretty much introduced me to every piece of technology in high school. So, but no one else would email me. I was also at that time trying to like get girls. It's like, hey, there's this thing called email. And if you had an email address, and then, but I got no takers. And so anyway, and went to college, studied art in college, painting. And then turned out that I didn't like that so much, but I started doing work, doing design, because I learned how to use Photoshop and I learned how to kind of lay things out for the newspaper. And I knew how to do some stuff from just the tinkering around that I'd always been doing. So I got a job working at Oakley, a sunglasses company.
How did you get that job?
I actually got that job through connection. The assistant basketball coach at my high school was the CFO of Oakley Sunglasses.
Okay.
I grew up in this small town on an island near the border of Canada, in Washington State in the United States, but near the border of Canada. and he had chosen to live there. He lived in California, and he would commute back and forth. So he was a basketball fan. And yeah, anyway, I got a job for the summer working there. They were like, we need somebody who knows how to make animated GIFs. And I knew how to do that. So I was like, so they put me in the web team. And I was like, hey, this design stuff is pretty fun. So yeah, then I got a job at Microsoft. I dropped out of school for a while. I finally finished. And
how
then,
did you go from Oakley to Microsoft?
I actually had a job in the middle working at a temp agency in Seattle that mostly placed people at Microsoft, but other tech companies in Seattle. This is like around the time right after the dot-com bust. So it's kind of hard to get a job actually in tech. So I went and worked there for like a year after having been the receptionist at this temp company for like a good solid, you know, year probably. Went and did that and then worked on Microsoft Encarta, which was an encyclopedia.
Who remembers that?
Yeah. If you don't know what an encyclopedia is, it's like Wikipedia, but books. And the big innovation with Encarta was to put it on CD-ROMs. So it was nice. Like instead of 30 books, you'd have 6 CDs. So big improvement.
What were you doing on the Encarta team?
I was a software designer. And, you know, I came in at the lowest level. I didn't really know anything except how to use Photoshop at that point. There was a great design team there. The guy who ended up designing the Windows Metro, like the Microsoft Metro design stuff. So if you're familiar with like Windows 10 and like the Windows Mobile stuff that was finally really cool, maybe way too late. He had actually designed the original version of Encarta like back in the early 90s. Anyone remembers what Windows looked like back then, but Encarta was different. It was all flat. It had this custom like menus. Everything was like totally flat, kind of Swiss design. And there was this whole team of designers there, Sheila and Angela, who's great graphic designers and taught me a lot about how to do design. So I worked there for like 5 years at Microsoft. We were building at one point at Microsoft, trying to build a touchscreen device with an app store. And it fell apart. And yet, you imagine my chagrin when that turned out to be like a thing that you could.
I'm just kind of interested about the transitions. How did you go from working on Encarta, the coolest thing of all time, to then going, and that was in Seattle?
Yeah, that's in a town near Seattle called Redmond.
Then to Mountain View to Google, right? Or
actually, at first I worked for Google. I worked in Seattle. So I lived in Seattle and there was an office. They opened up an office, presumably just to sort of poach employees from Microsoft. But I worked there for a while, about a year and a half. And then my family and I moved to Zurich to work at the Google office there. I was working on Gmail and a 20% project that eventually became Google Hangouts, the video chat. And then I moved back after a year and a half. We moved back to Seattle. We're there for another year or so, and then moved down to California. And then after being in California for a year, that's when I switched over to Google Ventures, 5 years there, and then we're here.
Cool. So Google, let's go back there for a second. Okay. So you worked on Hangouts, you worked on Gmail. Maybe let's talk about Hangouts because you said it was a 20% project. So that's Google's sort of 20% free time work on something on the side.
If you've already done everything else.
Yeah, if you've already done everything else.
Yeah, the phrasing sounds very, very nice. But yeah, it was hard to get Fridays off consistently. Okay.
Can you maybe talk about what you did on the Google Hangouts project?
There's a way of telling it that makes me sound really cool. And there's a way that's probably more honest. I mean, I think the honest way to say it is that right around the time that I started working at Google in Seattle, the team that made Google Talk, I don't know if anybody remembers Google Talk, but like it used to be if you had a Windows computer, there was like an app that would run on the computer that was chat. So it was called Google Talk. And then that is now that's in Gmail, which I think a lot of people are familiar with. You can chat in Gmail. But a lot of that team was up in Seattle. And when I started working at Google, they were like, you're in charge of this thing, Google Talk, which is cool. There were very few designers at Google when I started. So few enough that you would be in charge of like a thing, or there would only be like maybe a couple other people working on like a thing that you had heard of if you were outside Google. So I was pretty excited about that. And so Google had just acquired a company in Sweden who made video conferencing software, and a company called Meritech. And so there was this thought that eventually we could bring video into the chat stuff. And it's kind of related to chat because it's real-time communication. And so there was like a connection right away. I got connected with these guys in Sweden. And we were like, I was like, oh, wow, cool. So my mind is just spinning about working at Google in like 2007. I'm like, okay, let's try to do something really cool here. And the thing that sounded really cool was to be able to do multi-user video chat in a browser. Like, I don't think that sounds very cool today, but at that time there was Skype. So you could do like one-to-one calls and you do those with an app. You could do multi-user like video conferencing for a meeting, but it was really expensive. You had to buy a display, buy a camera. Sort of system. Yeah. There was a company called Tanberg that Google used, and you pay by the minute however many people were dialed in or different locations. So the thought that Google could make that free and change the market for that kind of thing and make it something you could just have in the browser was like, I was excited about that. So we were for a long time trying to figure out how do we make that into a product and how do we go from the technology that they have and the technology over time they built on the back end and make it a product. And so for a long time, trying to figure out the product part was a 20% project. So we were doing that on the side of doing Gmail and doing these other things that everybody knew was important. Everybody knew Gmail was important. People weren't too sure whether this video thing would ever stick. And then what happened, and this ended up being one of, for me, the sort of inspiration points for the design sprint process, was this week that I was in Stockholm. I went there for a week when I was in Zurich. So I went up to Stockholm for a week and spent a week with these two other guys who were working on the project with me. And we said, like, look, let's clear our calendars for the week and see what we can do. And, you know, we like kind of sketched out a UI, and this engineer, Mikael, he just like cranked it out. He built this prototype. As I said, they had the backend stuff working. So he connected it up so it would work in the browser. And we started using it on our team for meetings. So you could type in a URL like go/meet/, you know, Jake or whatever. And then like anybody could type that in and they would be in the meeting inside Google if you were on the Google network. We were like, oh, wow, this is really kind of cool. And so that ended up spreading around Google and people started using it. It was sometime later, but eventually that launched as Google Hangouts.
You said that the week that you kind of, you know, sketched out the UI and prototyped it was a bit of an inspiration for the sprint itself. Yeah. I mean, how did you go from sort of doing your normal Google process to what is now the sprint?
Yeah. It's more clear in hindsight than it was at the time. It sounds like I had like a strategy if I tell it right, looking back. Working at Microsoft on Encarta. Encarta comes out every year because you want to have it come out for back to school shopping. So it has to come out in like late summer. So it's going to be in stores. So you know like exactly what the process looks like. In late summer and fall, you are figuring out what you're going to be building. And then it's a waterfall, like 1 year long process. This is what we're going to build. Spec it out, design it, engineer it, ship. It's got to be done in time to go to manufacturing because you don't like just launch stuff. It's your manufacturing shipped. And so you really like that year was like, you knew exactly how the process was going to work. Then when I came to Google, I was like, Google had this reputation for moving really fast and being like a big company that was a startup. And like when I came in, I was like, it was remarkably similar to the way we'd work at Microsoft. The thing is, it takes a while to build something, you know, and I think that's often what happens when people want to move really fast and they want to like launch quickly and learn, which is a good idea. But if you want to build something of high quality, it's going to take time. Mostly the difference was that people at Google thought it was going to happen in less than a year, but it actually didn't. And the team who'd been building and shipping Encarta for 10 years, like they knew what that looked like. So what sort of happened with that week was after working at Google and seeing these processes, you know, sometimes take longer and seeing how I got stuck in churn where I'd be designing something, we'd figure out this is the way the product should look up front. And then later on, an engineer would come up with an idea that I had to admit was maybe better than my idea, or at least interesting. And we'd go back to the drawing board and then we might reconsider how the product should work. Also times when we spent a long time building something and weren't really sure that customers were going to be able to make sense of it. And those things started to kind of add up and aggravate me. There were these moments and projects, and one of them was Hangouts. And another one was a project I worked on when working on Gmail, where we had an engineer who had volunteered to work on, this is another sort of 20% project thing, for 4 weeks. And so each week I would design a new version of the UI. She would build it and we would launch it. And we did that like week after week after week for 4 weeks. I was like, my God, I did so much more. We did so much more as a team because we had that constraint. So the thing that occurred to me post those things was like, I'm frustrated with the way I'm working. Why am I not doing a better job? Why are we as a team not doing better? And when I looked back, I thought, like, maybe we could recreate that week. Like, why not try to artificially create that week?
How were you ideating? Were you taking like off the shelf things from IDEO, or how was that actually working pre-design sprint?
In the early days, I mean, I didn't go to design school, so I didn't really know what to do. And I would...
Probably a good thing.
I'd gone to art school and, you know, I'd studied drawing and painting. And so you
paint the UI.
Yeah. So I would paint the UI and it was frustratingly inefficient.
Smelly.
Yeah. I would like draw stuff on paper. I would try to do multiple versions of things. I would do a lot of versions in Photoshop. And that was something that my first manager at Microsoft, Sheila Carter, which was her name. It still is her name, but she taught me like, you've got to do a lot of versions. And that was partly, I think, her way to teach me design was like, if I did like 10 versions, it was easier to tell me why this one is better than that one than to like tell me in advance how design works. you know, you learn that way. You can make a lot of mistakes, you learn that way. For a long time, I didn't really know. I didn't really know what process to follow. I think something that happens a lot is that designers complain a lot about not being respected, but actually I think often we're respected too much. People say like, look, you're the designer. What you come up with, I trust you. You're the expert. And I was like, yeah, I am the expert. But really, I wasn't. I was like a 22, 23-year-old kid. I didn't know. And I mean, even when I got to Google and had been doing it for 10 years, they gave me that respect, but I didn't really know. And I think that's very dangerous. You put any person in charge, one person, and we don't know. It's a process of, you have to figure it out.
But don't you think that's part of kind of being a good designer? Maybe what separates the good ones from the ones who kind of stay where they are, that even though you don't know what you're doing, you're kind of enthusiastically trying to do it?
Yeah. No, I think that's true. But I think it's hard to be told that you're the expert. I mean, maybe other people are more self-aware and humble than I am. But if you tell me I'm the expert and I should be in charge, I would gladly grab that banner, you know, and march with it. So, yeah. But then what happened when I came to Google was, even when I knew what things I should do when designing, I would often not do them because I'd have some idea, I would get attached to it. I'd start, you know, putting it together in Photoshop. And I don't know if people use Photoshop anymore, but so Photoshop's like Sketch. So you would...
For old
people. Yeah, it's for old people. Yeah, it's like I'd get really into it and I would like figure out all of how it worked. I'd already be in like pitch mode, you know, because I was really attached. Like even if I knew what I should have done, I wasn't doing it. So this idea of we follow this process was really appealing to me. And I started facilitating these like 1 and 2 day kind of brainstorm workshops for teams around Google, maybe different teams. And so I did that for like maybe over the course of like a couple years. And I must have done 25 of those or so. That was another huge input to the sprint process, because obviously that idea of structuring time and that idea of saying, look, we're going to do our design work in a way where we involve everybody, not just the design team and the product managers, but the engineers. And we're going to be really, you know, thoughtful and deliberate about the steps. And especially as I started developing what became the design sprint process, it was partly in a way to like get the best out of that culture and also try to contain the worst of it. Like there's a lot of energy there and a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of really smart people. And you want to harness that early. Because I found a lot of times, as I said, I would be in that situation where I had my perfect Photoshop files or whatever, and I was attached to them. And then an engineer would come along and she might say, look, why doesn't it work this way? And I'd be like, I don't know. That's a really good question. I don't know why it doesn't work that way. And then I would like redo and going like this and like this and like this, like the timeline from the side gets really long.
Yeah, that's how we used to work as well. No, I don't remember. Yeah. Actually, we started with the design sprints 2011 before you, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So how did you go from like this sort of, let's say, disparate workshops and kind of working within Google to formalizing the design sprint? How did you have the balls to say, now that's mine?
I wanted to, like I said, like kind of harness all the great things about the engineering culture. We could be doing more. And there is a lot of material and like energy here. But when you see projects start, it's not working well. And actually, the name design sprint was really deliberately chosen because engineers were dependent on the person. But there's a general, sometimes I think, skepticism where the understanding of design wasn't what you'd hope. And so part of the idea was, look, it's design, but the word sprint makes it sound really practical and fast. And it was in a lexicon that they were familiar with. They were like, okay, a sprint is that's a unit of time where you're doing something. Okay, I'm with you so far. We're going to design, we're going to make a prototype or come up with the design in a week. Like, that's really good. So part of it was like selling this idea of a different way of working to the engineers. And I wanted to do it because I was frustrated with the way I was doing my own work. Also, here's this opportunity in this company that I really am excited about to do something cool. So it was really to sell it to Googlers, and it worked. So then by the time I started talking about it publicly, I actually had a lot of confidence that it worked. And it worked so well from the beginning that, you know, the first sprint where we actually went all the way through a week and made a prototype, and it had like competing ideas. It was so much different than anything else. And something launched from that first sprint. They took one of those ideas and built it and launched it in Gmail. In fact, if you use Gmail, it's a small thing, but it's still there, which is pretty impressive because this is like 7 years ago. If you use Gmail and you're in a message and it has like the contact details on the side of the person, you're looking at an email and it's like Jonathan Courtney, you know.
Always that. Sort of, yeah, no matter who you're looking at.
It is static.
That's the bug.
But we chose Jonathan. Partly it was my early attempts to get in this room.
But anyway, that
came from the first design sprint ever. So that was so different from brainstorm workshops and things I'd done in the past where things didn't launch, things didn't stick. It was the early days of Google Ventures, and we were trying to build our reputation, you know, as a credible investor. We thought one way to do that is to talk about the design work we're doing, and that was something that would have been more difficult to do at Google at that time.
Why?
For one thing, it wasn't on my radar while I was working on, you know, Gmail or whatever. We would write blog posts when we launched something, but the idea of sharing our process, it just wouldn't have occurred to me. It wasn't like the frame of mind I had.
Okay.
Like, I think GV sort of awakened this thought, and all of us who were there, all of the design partners, like, okay, we'd all most recently worked at Google. We're like, okay, we have to think a little bit more like a startup. We have to build a reputation for ourselves. The Google name isn't necessarily an asset, but I was confident. We were all confident that, hey, this thing works. We've been doing it for a while and we've seen it.
And how did it turn into the book, like now the artifact that kind of made it famous?
I wrote the blog post, well, I should say with help from my colleagues, John Zaratsky, Daniel Burke came on later, and we wrote those posts. The reception to them was surprisingly like good. I didn't really know what to expect when sharing that stuff. And a lot of people read them. I think honestly, I kind of hoped that the posts would go out there and people would be like, oh man, that guy's really cool. I really want to work with him. We should take money from Google Ventures. Like that would have been success. But then it turned out that people like read it and they're like, okay, well, we could probably do what that guy's doing. He's not that smart. And they did it and it worked, which meant that, you know, actually I wasn't the special magic ingredient, which I had kind of hoped, but it spread because I think it worked. And people started trying it and doing it and saying like, oh, this is different. The feedback from it was so positive and so exciting. And we were still in that mode of like, okay, we want to build our reputation. What's another good thing we can do? And on our crazy list of ideas at some point appeared, you know, write a book. And I've always really enjoyed writing, or for the past maybe several years, been really into it. I just got more and more tunnel vision on that idea. And then I built a prototype eventually of a book because I wanted to figure out, is this idea worth doing? And when you build a prototype in a sprint, the obvious target for that is your customers. When your customers come in on Friday, you show it to them and you learn a lot from doing it. I spent a week making a prototype of this book and I combined some of the blog posts, so materials from the blog posts, and I wrote part of a story in there about Blue Bottle Coffee. I wrote a little bit of that. I drew some pictures. I made a fake cover, which was hideous.
It's a photo of
this
you.
Cover. Yeah, it was a photo of me.
I didn't mean the hideous part. I just mean, yeah. Damn it.
No, I get it. I get it. Yeah.
Take what you meant. Turn off the lights.
Yeah. I did show it to people. The other part of when you build a prototype in a sprint is seeing it for yourself, right? And seeing like, okay, if we did this thing, what would it be like? When it's concrete, that's so much different than the abstract idea. So the abstract idea of a book is interesting, but then seeing it and saying like, okay, this is what the first 25 pages might look like. Like I took a hardcover book and like literally like put the printed out jacket around it. And it was like, this is what it would feel like to have a book in your hands, you know? And I was like, oh, that'd be really cool. Like, I really want to do that. John and Braden, everybody on our team was like, oh yeah, that would be cool. And so that was kind of the first like, okay, we're really going to get serious about doing this.
You've worked on a lot of really interesting products. Like, I'm actually not sure out of this list which ones you've worked on, but there's like Slack, like Medium as well, products like this. But maybe you can just like pick one or two out that you found interesting. Maybe it doesn't have to directly be a product design sprint, but maybe any sprints that you found interesting.
I have been really, really lucky. And actually, a lot of the story, I like to tell the story to make it sound like I was really choosing the paths and the smart guy along. But I've been really lucky in where I turned up at the right time. And one of the places that turning up at Google at the right time when you could jump around and work on different projects was really cool. And Google Ventures was amazing because they invested in all these cool companies who, you know, to be clear, were already doing really cool stuff. And then I got to like pop in and work with them for a week. I think that actually some of the ones that stand out the most are not ones that people have heard of. In the book, I tell the story of this company called Flatiron Health, who makes software for cancer care clinics. And it's a super complicated problem. In the United States, healthcare is kind of a mess. And so we have like insurance companies and you have government who run some of these clinical trials on cancer therapies. You have pharmaceutical companies running the trials. You have hospitals and cancer care clinics, doctors and patients. And the idea with Flatiron Health is that if you were able to organize some of the data that the clinics have around different therapies and their outcomes, and if you were able to understand what traits their cancer has, because humans' understanding of cancer has changed a lot in the last decade. We know a lot more about how particular one person's instance of cancer can be and how a lot of it is driven by the alterations, the genetic alterations that drive the tumor growth. And so there's a lot of very specific treatments that they want to try out, but the population of people who it might work for is, it might be a few dozen people in the United States hunting for a needle in a haystack. And part of the idea of what they were doing when we sprinted with them, the story that's in the book, is trying to figure out if we built a tool, a really sophisticated tool, like everything we know about their cancer, could we match them to the ideal therapy? Could we match them to a clinical trial for something new? They have to start therapy as soon as possible when they've been diagnosed. So you have a very short time to do that. And that was really cool because it was so hard. It was really hard to come in as an outsider, especially because I'm not very bright, and try to understand what they were doing and how the science of it worked well enough to facilitate and take part in the sprint. And then what's really cool is that because we were an investor, Google Ventures is an investor in that company, we got to work with them over time. So over the course of years, you saw how going from that first sprint when they were first trying out that idea and then they were testing it and then like, and it was first starting to work and they're starting to match patients with trials. And it's really exciting because it's a big, hard problem that they were taking on. It's exciting to work with people who are doing that. I really found that you get inside most companies and you find there's interesting problems. There's people who are excited to work on those things. One thing that's so cool about design sprint process is I think it often unlocks the drive, the ambition, the reason why people signed up to work for that company. For that week, you feel like, yeah, like there's like a one-to-one match. This is why I'm here. This is why I wanted to do this thing. And so I think it's, that one's obviously inspiring. They're trying to save lives, but that feeling of making good use of your time is there in almost every sprint. And I always left sprints feeling like, yeah, like that was awesome. And I feel like all of our time spent together was well spent. Ultimately, that's the most important thing.
What was the prototype of after 1 week of doing a problem that complex?
Yeah, it was like, I think, remarkably simple. What they really had to do was mapped out all of these different players in this thing. And the map that's in the book is a simplified version of the real map, because I felt like it would maybe already make people's head hurt to read that story. But in reality, we had all these different players, like the pharmaceutical companies who are running the trials and all these things, and then figuring out how that all worked. What's the key spot? Is the key spot when the doctor is talking to the patient? Is that the most important moment? You know, is there some way you can educate doctors about trials? Or is it the patient has to agree to do a clinical trial? Sometimes that's a very uncomfortable feeling to try something that's not the proven therapy. There's all these questions about where they should focus. And they decided to focus on the people who in these cancer care clinics are coordinating the trials. So there's somebody whose job it is to know what trials are available and then to sort of be on the lookout for patients. The question was, if we came up with a tool that could suggest matches, what would we have to do to make them believe it? And how much information would we have to give them to make them change their normal course of action in time? There was a few components to what they built, but the key thing was like, what's in the email that they get every day? What shows up in their inbox? And it's funny because that whole product is so sophisticated, but you can start to get a sense of whether it's going to be worth investing years of time in that by testing the email. It sounds sort of silly, but that's actually often true. I think you go upstream of the most complicated part of the product, and you often find the part that you can test. You find this like interaction point where people are making a decision about whether this thing is worthwhile, and you start to get a sense of, is there something here?
Do the companies like that need to know exactly what they want to do before they start a sprint, or exactly what the problem is, or can the sprint itself sort of surface that problem? So if they would just say, you were saying that the company, that people realize why they're working there, so it's like a positive therapy section something.
Yeah.
So if they just said, we're going to do a sprint every quarter, do you think that that would actually help the company, even if they wouldn't have anything to really work on or something, nothing specific?
No, I think that actually is a good practice to set aside a week every quarter. Over time, that's what we started to recommend to people and started to see companies doing near the beginning of a quarter where they would be maybe setting their quarterly goals, their OKRs, whatever. And they'd say, look, here's this big thing. We've already got the time cleared on everybody's calendar. And if you decide you don't have to run the sprint, I mean, we would see that that's a good way to do it. That cadence is about right. if you feel like you have that capacity to like focus your effort every quarter, you know, on a regular basis, and it isn't a special thing, you have to kind of change course to make time for the sprint, it helps a lot.
Why did it take off? Why is it like kind of famous in the design community when every single person and their dog comes up with a new process every day?
Is that true?
I have like 12 processes since yesterday.
Yeah. It's kind of you to say it's famous. I don't know that it's famous.
Well, I think that it's like, it's fairly well known as a tool for a product.
Partly because it has a generic name. So it sounds like something that you should have known about already if you hear the name. I mean, one of the things that helped it a lot, obviously, was being able to attach the Google name to it helped open the door for it. So I think many people were receptive to paying attention to it in the first place because it said Google. That was a huge advantage to getting started. And I also think that to have been in a situation where I could try and fail with processes for a long time, I had many different 20% projects. And one of them was running these workshops for a while. And those workshops that didn't really ever work real well. And then I started experimenting with the design sprint process. And some of them worked and some of them didn't. But I was kind of changing and modifying the process over the course of a couple years. And then being able to try and fail and be able to jump from team to team and work during that time with so many high quality teams, but not have to convince them to pay me because I was just on salary. I just worked at Google and then I worked at Google Ventures. So the teams at Google weren't paying for it. The startups weren't paying for it. We were paying them. We were investing in their companies. And then like I was showing up. So that was really fortunate. And it meant that I got a bunch of reps, really found out. I was lucky to work with at Google Ventures, a group of designers who were really always trying to come up with a better way. Let's look really critically at what happened last week and try to tweak it, try to improve it. To be able to get so many reps doing it and tweak it the whole time and not be punished for your failures and not be trying to run a business at the same time, that was really unique. And so I think the resulting process is the result of a weird situation. And that's part of why it spread is I think people see it and they're like, this is different. And the stuff that's in here, I hope that it appeals to people who are pragmatic. And they look at it and they say, okay, this feels like if we do this, we're going to get somewhere. And I think there has been a need for that. That's why all those things together is why it works.
I think what's interesting is that you guys kind of put the sprint process together and you weren't trying to sell it. So it's not like you're trying to sell this drawn out process. It was a process that you guys wanted to use on the startups you're investing in to validate for the people that I talk to about the design sprint process. And especially here, the reason why we use it is it's like a no BS approach with very little fat.
Yeah. And that's partly a process in the early days of get it to work with Google engineers who were really did not take any BS. I'd been facilitating these group brainstorm workshops. And then I was teaching a class in Zurich to like 100 engineers about how you do this brainstorming process. And I'm like partway through the class and this guy stands up, this Google engineer, and he's like, hey, how do you know that this group brainstorming stuff really works? And I was like, shut up. Trying to run in a class, you just got to trust the process. And, you know, we don't have time to get into that right now. And then in my mind, I'm like, I was just like, how do I know that it works? You know? And I think there's a lot of stuff like that where we don't really know that it works. And to some degree, like sometimes you just do have to trust. If you've done something a bunch and you get good results, you have to trust it. But Google engineers were very critical. They were both trusting and critical. It had to be no nonsense. And that actually just being immersed in that mindset changed the way I approach things. And this guy who I went to art school, but I became very no nonsense about things. And then I think the other part of it is that we were, as you said, we weren't trying to add hours to it. We wanted when working with a startup to be in as quick as possible and also to teach them because we had a team of 5 and then 6 designers, like 350 companies in the portfolio. So there's no hope of us working with all of them all the time. The best you could do is to pick off the best opportunities, do a project with them and hope that not only did you help in that time, but that you taught them something culturally that they could take with them. And so the part of the intent with it was this should be stuff that imparts the culture that you want the company you've invested in to have. It gives them a way to do design. If design is new or forming, you want them to be able to take it with them and go and run with it. That is an unusual motivation.
And I think that the last time I spoke to you, it's on YouTube, by the way. You haven't said it yet. It was... You said something really interesting. You said one thing that like really kind of, at least for your startups and the startups that GV was working with, just being able to give a team a process so that they don't have to think about the process the whole time and can just focus on the problem solving is huge.
Yeah.
Because that's something when we were starting out, we were just pulling bits and pieces from different processes. And that's actually what a lot of agencies are still, you know, you're just like, okay, that
well, you have to. You have to try to figure out what works. And so, yeah, I think that's the nicest thing is to not have to think, how should I do this? Am I doing this in the right way? But just to feel like, okay, just solve the problem. It's not like then, like you don't have any hard work to do. I mean, then you have the hardest work to do, but it's such a relief, I think, to not have to do that. So if you can trust that it's going to work, I think at this point you can. If you follow those steps,
it doesn't work for us.
Doesn't work for you guys. If you are of at least normal intelligence, it'll work for you every time.
What's the hardest part of a design sprint?
The hardest part for me is Monday is always hard. I've run a lot of design sprints. There's like a point in Monday when I'm like, this is work? Is this going to come together?
Same for us.
And it does. But when you have that moment of doubt, I think it's like 2:25 in the afternoon is probably when I usually have that moment. But it's hard because you're really trying to get your head around the problem. If you're working with a team who hasn't done it before, you have to build credibility with them and you have to make them feel like you're not feeling that way at 2:25 in the afternoon. The map is, for me, always messy. I think we've talked about this a little bit. And actually, I just taught my first two workshops on this last week. And I realized that the map, I want some better tools for people to do the map, because I've always found that if you draw it and redraw it and ask people questions, it works. And I found that it doesn't have to be perfect and it works. But I think that it would be nice to, in some of the ways that the other steps are more formulaic, that's the part where it'd be really nice to even be like more confident in this step by step. If we just do this thing piece by piece by piece, it'll come together. So I'd like that to be crisper. I also think Wednesday is hard. The storyboard can be hard. And it comes at a time when the energy is low from making a lot of decisions in the morning. And everything on Wednesday is optimized so that you'll spend as little brain power as possible with each decision. So you'll reserve as much decision-making willpower that you need to make those decisions as possible. But still, the afternoon can be very...
I didn't actually ask you this. Did you guys ever test out the process we added in just before the storyboard?
Yeah, I actually tried that and then I quit not long afterwards.
It was just too
horrible. No, but I actually tried it for the map on Monday.
Okay, yeah.
It worked pretty well, although I wanted to experiment more with it. If you guys aren't already familiar with the process that these guys use at AJ and Smart for the storyboard, it's, what do you call it? You have a cool name for it, right?
I don't know if we ever came up with a name for it. Pre-storyboard jig.
For those of you in this room and those of you watching at home, these guys blog about their things that they do in the process, and it's really good. The processes are really, you know, I've used them and stuff, but you're terrible at naming them. I mean, the names are
really, I know.
So they do this thing where each person comes up with their own story, their own rough, like, here's how it should work. And they do it on sticky notes, step by step by step. So you're doing the kind of parallel work, which is really, I think, where both the map and the storyboard get hard, is because it's the thing I hate. It's everybody
Everyone's talking.
Everybody talking is just, it just sucks my will to live. So I, like,
sucks
if you,
will.
If you put, yeah, if you, but everybody does individually their own sticky notes and then puts them up. And then the facilitator is meant to have a chance to try to make sense of it. And we tried doing that for the map, and I thought it helped a lot. But I think there's something there. There's something to both of those parts that could be better.
At least when we're moderating sprints, the Monday, so we split it into four quarters in terms of difficulty. Quarter one is like the morning of Monday, and this is what we consider to be the most difficult. And that's kind of like the expert interviews part and getting everybody on board and getting everybody to trust that, in our case, they pay up front. So it's even worse, you know, and like these big companies come into this office, they're like, well, what did we just pay
for?
Then the storyboarding part for us is also like a 10 out of 10 in difficulty, because so it's the map and the storyboard, the expert interviews, the map and the storyboard, and everything else you can kind of just read it out and just talk it out. But those two things, they can make or break the entire thing.
It's hard at the end of the day on Friday to make sense of what you learned in a way that you then feel like we can take action on this. We found the patterns. And one thing that since writing the book, we changed about the way we were doing it was to, rather than having everybody write on sticky notes, to have a list of questions, which were partly the sprint questions from Monday and partly questions that we had called out on the prototype. So for each part of the prototype, we basically try to have like a list of yes, no questions. You know, you might have like 5 to 10 questions printed out. Everybody has a printout and you're just basically writing for each participant like yes, yes, no, 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 or whatever. So at the end of the day, you kind of can score each thing. you kind of have this like red light, green light kind of feeling about the key part. You'll have other observations, but that helped out a lot. It felt like an oversimplification when we first started doing it, but it turns out that most of what you know or need to know is like in those few things. So yeah.
Last question before I pass you over to the live stream and the lovely people here. What's the biggest mistake people make in their first sprint?
The biggest mistake, modifying the process, which I just said has flaws, but it has flaws, but it works. And if you modify it the first time, you are very likely to have a sprint that doesn't work or that's inordinately hard for you. So some of the ways that people modify it is they'll try to make it shorter. Yeah, if you leave off the user studies and the prototype, which is, you know, if you're going to shorten it, that's the easiest way to do it. So many times we, on Wednesday afternoon, on Thursday afternoon, we think we are geniuses.
Yeah.
We have come up with an amazing thing. You're like pretty much ready to go. You're like, I guess we have the people scheduled to come in. We'll go through with the motions. But this time we nailed it.
Don't even need them.
Yeah. Never right. We're never right. So, you know, you do the test and you're like, oh, yeah. You know, and then you figure out what the gap is between what's perfect in your head, even in the prototype, and the real world. And then what I think is amazing about it is when the whole team watches and the whole team has all the context, you almost always understand how to build the bridge, how to get from that imperfect thing to the real world. And like, I think the difference between sprint one and sprint two is always insane. Huge. It's always insane. I understand why people want to do it in a shorter amount of time. And I understand the feeling, like if you're at that point of feeling like, yeah, well, that was good. Let's go. But that's really dangerous. You guys have a sensible way of shortening to 4 days. And I don't think it's crazy to shorten it to 4 days if you do all the steps. People do sometimes try to compress it to 3 days. If you try to do all of the steps and cram it into too short of a time, I would never advise anyone to even shorten it to 4 days unless they had done it once, right? Yeah. So you got a sense of these are the places where we're going to compress or change or whatever. And it's just like if you're baking a cake or something, you should follow the recipe once the first time before you've put, you know, lard in instead of butter or whatever it is you're going
to
do.
Actually, just relating to you saying, okay, I don't even need to do the user test where this, we nailed it.
Yeah.
This week, the whole AJ and Smart team, we thought we nailed it. Like we were 100% sure that the thing we were going to test on Thursday, we were like, okay, I booked all the tests anyway. All the tests are happening. But seriously, I was even like, should I just start canceling? Like, even though it was an internal sprint, I would never have said it for the client. First, second, third, fourth, fifth test, full failure on every single one of them. So every single, like we were 100% wrong. But after the test was like, holy crap. Now it's so obvious what we should do.
Right.
So like, but honestly, there would have been a time where we would have built the thing.
Yeah.
Like definitely.
Oh, yeah,
we would have definitely built it.
Yeah.
And we would also, then when people would have given us feedback, we would have been like, they just don't understand it.
Yeah.
And we would have lost so much money.
Yeah.
But it was like, the cool thing is like third test in when we realized it's complete dud, we were able to go from, we're all in love with it to, okay, well, it's dead. And now we know what to do next. So I think you kind of get into this almost throwaway mindset, which actually helps you to release products a little bit better.
Yeah, totally. It's that thing that used to happen to me where I get attached to the idea and then you'd start to get more resistant to any data.
That.
The first story in the book is about this robot, this hotel delivery robot that makes deliveries in hotels, doesn't deliver hotels. It's
it's big robot.
In my experience, and like I've probably done over 150 design sprints, that is like the most successful actually outcome of the test. Largely because the people who built the robot are really smart. Like they did a lot of things right and it worked. And it's kind of bait and switch because if you read the book, the first one is like number one out of 150 of like most successful in terms of like the test. Like a lot of the stuff worked. They were testing a personality for the robot and it tested really well. And I kind of did that to lure people into the book. But the reality is they're supposed to fail. And then by failing, you figure out how to fix it.
And I think that a lot of companies, when they actually start doing sprints internally and they see that first failure, if they're not already told up front that that's even a good thing, then they'll stop doing it forever. They're like, well, there's no point in us actually blocking this time ever again because that didn't work.
Yeah.
It depends how you kind of tell people about it, but there's definitely people telling people that, well, it works every single time, first time around. And well, if it didn't, then you did it wrong.
Yeah. And I think one of the downsides of the way that we tried to like sell the process and get it to spread was in making it sound like it's going to work so well.
It's your fault.
Because, well, part of it is, I mean, because part of it is like to get people to try it, try to be very rosy about it. And it does work, but working sometimes is very painful. But the definition of work is you learned something. And we say that in the book. It's a painful process. So it's like everybody wants to fall in love, but you're going to probably get your heart broken most of the time. So, but you got to do that to get it right eventually. So it's,
And with that emotional ending, we're going to pass it on to the audience here. So if you have any questions, just put up your hands, and I guess I'll start with you because you're first.
What's interesting to me is that you kind of started off like with this process with startups, right? And then trying to like get this kind of like process going with startups. And then bigger companies are looking at it going, shit, we need to like cut our product cycles down, and our innovation cycles need to be faster. So we're looking at this process. You mentioned it with Fine Health, I think, as well, where the company even started with this sprint. Like they bought some.
They did early on. They were, I don't want to oversell. It wasn't where they got the idea for the company or anything, sure. But yeah.
No, but this idea then where companies are coming together, in the case of Flatiron Health, yeah. Maybe some back-end stuff plugged into it. So do you see also then the sprint as a nice little catalyst?
Yeah, and really that was one of the big aims of doing it at Google Ventures. And when I started doing it at Google too, was having worked as a designer there for a few years, was hoping to change the culture of the way design and the way products were built there. It's a great way to try to change culture. It's not a promise that it will change culture, but it's a great way to try it. And I think things like that are a great method if people are trying, maybe even in different ways, to change culture, because it's like, here's this one thing you can do. Here's a recipe. One of the ideas in a sprint that is true in the sprint for the way you think about the product, but it's also true for the way you can think about it culturally, is we're not going to flip a switch and do this forever. And I think a lot of times people are like, when we make a decision about something, it's a forever decision. So we're rolling out this new HR policy. This is the policy now. We're going to decide what we're going to build. This is what we're going to build. And like, once you do it, then you're stuck with it. And the idea with the sprint is, no, we're going to try it. And like, we'll see how it goes. And the nice thing about it for a cultural change perspective is, it's like, we'll try it for a week. And like, if it sucks, then we don't have to do it. But I think it does insidiously, it like changes the way people approach working with each other and approach thinking about solving problems. And I was actually in the DDR museum today here in Berlin, and they have on the wall the schedule for like a day in kindergarten, and they have photos of like the kids all eating at the same time and all like in their uniforms, like jumping at the same time and all like going to the toilet at the same time. And they were like, yeah, they use this rigid structure to like inoculate them with a socialist, you know, mindset. And I was like, yes.
I love it.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, because sort of frame like you do things as a whole, and you know, individuality matters less. You do things as a whole for the good of everyone.
Nobody really thinks that they're looking stupid, but everybody's
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so it's like, if you follow that process, it's inoculating you into the culture I want your team to have, which is actually people do behave very individually. They do work on their own. You have a different way of having conversations. You have a different way of making decisions. And I hope that it plants some, you know, insidious seeds of change.
This is a question from Edith. And Edith asks, how would you suggest convincing a boss or colleagues to try a sprint when they haven't done it before?
First thing you're going to want to do is buy a lot of copies of the book and just bring them in.
Two per person.
That conveys a lot of authority, just having lots of copies.
Social media.
Yeah. No, it's a question that comes up a lot, I think for good reason, because it's hard to convince people. And there are a few tactics that you can take. I think the first thing that you should know, if you're in the situation where you want to convince your team to run a sprint or convince a client to run a sprint or whatever, is that it might take a while, actually. Sometimes you can sell it right away, but sometimes it takes a while. And sometimes the thing is compelling. I think it was compelling when I first started trying to convince people at Google to do it, because you know, in the beginning, no one had heard of this thing, including me. And I was like, okay, I think what's good about this idea is we'll have a prototype in a week. And that was much faster than we would normally work. So I'll be getting your input on the team, and we'll have a prototype in a week. Sometimes what's compelling is you wait until you've got a problem, your project the team is working on, that everybody acknowledges is going to take a long time to figure out. And so that idea of moving fast is more obviously compelling. It always happens eventually to teams that they end up starting something and they're like, oh my gosh, like we have a lot to figure out. At that moment, if you say, well, maybe this is a time to try this thing that takes a week and we make a lot of progress, it seems more valuable. But if you introduce that and everything's like midstream, you know, and we're already building this thing, like that's not a good time. So I suppose that's obvious, but sometimes waiting for that time to be right, which could be aggravating. I know if you see like, oh, we're doing these other things that drive me nuts. And then that's another thing I think is to be really candid and say, we're doing these things that honestly, I think we're wasting time. I think this is a way to not waste time. I think you should be honest about it. And then I think another thing is to say it's an experiment. Like this is going to be an experiment. We're going to try it once. We'll all evaluate if it makes sense. You can blame me or, you know, anyone you like. It's like, it's not my thing. You can say it's this thing I read about or whatever. And I think we should try it. And you can try use social proof. There's a lot of companies now who are doing it. It's not just startups and Google. The other thing I think that I've come to suggest to people over time, maybe we talk about this in the book, but it's taking little pieces of the process and trying them in a normal meeting. So you can do the note and vote activity from the book. There's a lot of meetings where that's a better way to do it than the regular way. And there's a lot of pieces like that you could take out and do it. And then when you introduce the whole sprint, it's a lot of the pieces are familiar and they're better than the usual way of doing meetings. So it won't seem so weird to people. But I've heard of a lot of stories where people, it takes them a year or 2 years before they're really, the company's like, yeah, okay, let's do this. It's not crazy. Let's go for it. And as different industries start adopting it more, it becomes less weird in your industry or in your area where you are, like the you know, really the geography where you are, if teams are adopting it more.
This thing you said about taking out the small exercise is actually the perfect way in.
Yeah.
Because I mean, what we do every week is sell sprints to companies who maybe don't really want to do them.
Question. Yeah.
No, but I mean, actually that's the perfect thing. You pick one of the smaller exercises and you say, hey guys, at lunch, we'll try this exercise. And that's actually why we created the Lightning Decision Jam, was just taking bits of the sprint, crushing it down so that there's an outcome. And then the people say, oh, this actually works.
When you're selling it, when you go in to talk to a new team about this, do you do some of that stuff in the...
Yeah.
Okay.
So what we do is we do a lunch and learn. So what we just did last week is like a design sprint tour where we kind of traveled around Germany and did like these 3-hour Lightning Decision Jam sessions, which at the end of it, we know that there are outcomes. We know that the people have solved their problems in this tiny exercise. And then they're like, okay, if that worked, then this bigger thing might actually work. It is a difficult thing, not just the money, not just paying for the sprint, but stopping or getting their CEO or getting the people to say, okay, I'll stop working for 2 days or something like that. And I think that really, that is the perfect thing. Do the note or vote or do one of the small exercises. It does get people on board.
What's the kind of problem? If somebody was thinking, I want to run a sprint in my company and the Lightning Decision Jam is a way to like, a decision is valuable, right? If we can make a decision about something. So what's the threshold for the kind of decision where you would want to say, I'll try this out for the first time with my company, which is stressful for anybody to do.
I think with that Lightning Decision Jam thing, what you can do as a team is come up with the problems in the exercise.
Okay.
So it's like our team as a product, how can we improve the speed of our team could be like one of these things. And so it can be just, it can be something quite general, or it can be something like how might we problems get produced within the exercise. So we just let the company do it for themselves and they produce the problem. Or we choose like a canned problem, like some sort of weird, like a generic problem, a generic problem, and we have them solve it.
Yeah.
But it generally, that seems to be the thing that succeeds best for us to get people convinced to run them internally.
Are there any industries or types of companies where you think design sprints probably won't work due to the nature of the company? I don't know, a restaurant or a metalworks company, construction.
Yeah. When I started doing it, it was for consumer software. Those were the kinds of projects I was working on. When I came to Google Ventures, the first few we did were consumer, you know, apps or websites, whatever. My initial thought was, it makes sense to me that you could do a sprint on that because we can find those customers fast enough. I knew how to build those prototypes. I knew the kinds of questions you needed to answer because that was my history, was building those kinds of products. But because Google Ventures invested in all these different kinds of companies like, you know, like robotics companies, healthcare companies, different things, we ended up trying it. Let's give it a shot and found that it worked. What makes it work is usually the people who work on the team, who are the experts in the domain and the problem, being able to figure out what the key question is, and then how you would prototype a solution to that that fits in that spot. For example, with a restaurant, I wouldn't really know how to prototype a new way of serving. Like the question is like, we want to add a maitre d' and see if like we can class up the joint. And when people come in, they're going to feel like this is like a 5-star restaurant instead of the real dive that it really is. I wouldn't really know how to make that compelling. But if you ran a restaurant, you might have some good ideas about the changes you were going to make. And you'd probably be able to figure out, okay, to make this seem realistic for a night, for an evening, these are the changes we need to make. This is how we'll change the table settings, or this is how we'll schedule the service or whatever. A lot of times it's that thing that like building a industrial pump or something, like I would have no idea how to prototype an industrial pump. But the question about the industrial pump might be a very narrow piece of it. The new nozzle sprayer that we're going to use, is it better than the previous one? Are the controls better? And maybe you can 3D print that. Maybe it doesn't have to be as nicely machined as it would be when it launches. Or I'm using an example from the book, but if you have to hook this up into your assembly line and you just need to know how the cables work, like you can slice that piece off and you don't have to build the whole thing. So I think there are ways where it can work. And I think if a team goes into it and says, let's try it, it's harder to have that faith. You know, we just talked about building the faith. It's hard to build that faith to do it. But if you do it, I think actually it can work. People have the know-how usually to figure out how to prototype.
Okay, guys. So tonight's hashtag is industrial pumps. I'm going to pass it back there. Perfect.
So Tim and I are doing the prototype on the Wednesdays. And actually, one of the problems we're finding is that our prototypes are becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's based on typically your average 10-frame storyboard.
Yeah.
I think what we did a couple of weeks ago was 42 screens for iPad.
Yeah.
And the value that that gives the client, what's your advice or experience for when you create prototypes, when to draw the line, and how much do you actually have to physically include for the user test to kind of know whether it's going to be a viable option or not?
Well, how long is a piece of string? It's really the answer. I think that you've hit on something that we've encountered when working at Google Ventures, which was that we got better and better at building prototypes. So when we were working with teams, we could take on a bigger thing as we prototype. This will be true for any team that does sprints over and over again. We'll get better and better at prototyping fast. You'll know, like, this is the fidelity we need to reach. You'll have this sense of like, this is the way we use the tools, and you'll just get better at it. You know, you'll know the mindset. I mean, for you guys, this is like elementary stuff, but as a team is like starting to do it, the learning curve, you do get to prototype more and more. To me, the time is the way to cap it. I don't want to work long hours. So I'm not going to work a long hour on, you know, a long day on Thursday because I'm lazy and I stretch out the whole thing over 5 days. You know, I don't want that day to go on too long because I know Friday is like going to be taxing. I don't want to be worn out for Friday. And part of the whole spirit, I think, of the sprint should be that I feel like they should be tiring in a satisfying way, not in a we burn the midnight oil kind of a way. That's the way work should be. Work should be satisfying, but it shouldn't be round the clock. You never get to set it down. You should be able to leave the sprint on any day and feel like I'm satisfied with what happened today. I can go home and it's going to work. I can just be here. Like, I know it's getting a little bit out there for this answer, but really, like, that is it. I would just set a time and we're going to stop because there's no right answer. If you make it more detailed and like you add more to it, it will help the client more. But, you know, is another hour going to help them? Like, I think there's diminishing returns at some point. It's going to be more valuable because you guys are really good at prototyping that you did it than they did it. But I would never kill myself to do a super, super complex prototype.
Don't listen to that answer, guys.
Yeah.
Jake is wrong. Can we pass one back to Facebook just quickly? Because there's a pile of questions there.
Aaron asks, how would you run a sprint but for a one-person business?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, a couple of people have written Medium posts about their experience running a one-person sprint. So if you search for one-person sprint, you will find those posts and you'll see what it was like for a person to go through it. For me, it would be very difficult because I need peer pressure or I don't follow the rules. And that's part of the reason why I created this process in the first place, is to create peer pressure so I do what I should do. But if you have the moral fortitude to go through with it, it's doable. And if you don't have to deal with other people, some parts are a lot better, really. So go for it.
Smell.
But you're not going to have multiple solutions. So you're going to have to, you have to tweak it. But look at those posts and I have to see how the folks did.
In your experience, does having a facilitator who is not a designer change the dynamics of the sprint, or like, does it have any impact on the sprint? And if so, like, could you elaborate on that?
I am curious if you have experience with that, because you're right. I've been in knee every time I've been in a sprint, and so I don't really know firsthand. I've talked to a lot of, especially product managers are often the people who facilitate sprints. What I've heard is that it works pretty well, you know, and it seems to go fine. I think that actually I think it can be challenging for designers to, like, if you're a PM, you're probably comfortable facilitating a meeting. You know, that number is probably closer to 100% than it is for designers. If you look at the population of designers, it's sometimes harder to find someone who is a designer and is comfortable in that role. You have to be pretty like soft focus on the design itself during the thing. And I think that's actually challenging for a designer. And even after doing it a lot, I still sometimes want to kind of like manipulate the way people are heading with it. But I think there are advantages to having a non-designer do it. I think the key is really being comfortable with that facilitation role, which doesn't actually have to do with design. It's really about being comfortable telling people to stop talking and being comfortable saying like, look, we're going to do this awkward thing now, but it's weird, but we got to do it. And we got to move along. And then being able to capture and listen and do that stuff. This process will appeal to designers a lot of times because it's design-based, but it's actually as likely as not that a good facilitator would be anyway.
For us, the facilitator makes a huge difference to the sprint. So we test everybody at AJ and Smart running the sprint, and it definitely...
You get to give me their scores later.
Yeah, yeah. I have the scorebook. I don't think it matters if they're a designer or not. I think it matters whether they have product experience or not. And I think that that's where you see the difference. If they're able to bring up case studies in the sprint, and if they're able to control a room in a sort of, let's say, authoritative but friendly way, then they're going to nail it, and it doesn't matter if they're a designer or not. That's not an important thing. So for us, we're not looking for our facilitators to be designers. We're looking that they, especially because we're a product design company, we will want them to have worked on many products so that when we get into sort of like a bind with the client or if we get stuck somewhere, they can say, well, when we released for this industry and this product and this is what happened. And that's why we should just pass that point for now. At least that's where we're kind of coming from.
That's a really good point. And I think it's called a design sprint, right? It has the word design in it. But that's largely because in the beginning, like I was a designer. So I was trying to help teams at Google with design. And when we were doing it at Google Ventures, that idea of design, like startups knew they needed that. They were starting to be this awareness of like, yeah, we need to have that thing that's become more and more important. But what happens in a design sprint is really just like basic stuff. Like it's not design. It's just like, we need to make a decision about what we're going to do. We need to work together as like a few Homo sapiens in a room. And like, we need some guidelines for doing that because Homo sapiens aren't naturally great at, you know, building software and hardware without some rails. And like all the stuff that happens is really just basic, basic stuff. I told you the story about why I like named it that way, but it's not design even. I mean, there's design stuff in it, but it's product stuff. So if you have that confidence that, yeah, look, I've built a few products, this will work. A big job of the facilitator is to be confident. This makes sense. This is pragmatic. We are doing the right basic stuff. And if you can either do that or fake that really compellingly, I think that is the key.
I think so. I mean, I think that's also the reason it's difficult to scale AJ and Smart because of this one reason.
Nata asks,
hey, Nata.
If you could only change one thing from the book in a future edition, I think
I wish my name was bigger and then my photo was on the front.
Yeah.
Those are
the Jake book.
Obvious. I think version 2 should definitely have that. But it's the stuff we talked about. Making the map and making the storyboard and collecting the research on Friday. Those things are hard. And the way you describe them in the book, it will work. You can do it and it'll work. But those processes can get even better. There's room to improve there. You know, I have some ideas stolen from you and some ideas that we came up with at GV that I think would make it better.
You're probably talking from the point of view of someone that already has the process in place. How relevant would you see having an external moderator at the beginning?
If you can get an outside facilitator who's good to come in and do the sprint, then especially, you know, your first sprint, that's way better. If you're in a situation where you have to sell, like we're doing this new thing to your team, and then you're the one who facilitates, or you're the person facilitating it for the first time, you've never been in one, it's hard. It's actually part of the reason why I was surprised people took the blog post and the book. I'm surprised it's been as used as it has, because if you can save yourself from that difficulty, also there's this added advantage where if someone comes in from the outside, it's so much easier to ask the kinds of questions that need to be asked, which are naive questions, if you actually are naive about what's going on, if you really are an outsider. It's much easier to separate yourself from solving the problem if you're an outsider. And facilitating is hard. It's something that works when you follow the recipe, but to do it really well takes experience. So all those things go better when you have somebody come in from the outside. But it also is doable the first time following the recipe. There's no exact right answer because a lot of people don't have access for whatever reason to an outsider to do the first sprint. And clearly, you know, you can do it for the first time on your own.
Do you see it as a professional figure? Have you met people that just do that
Yeah, sure.
individually?
Yeah, I do know some folks who do that. I hope that there will be more and more people who are available to facilitate sprints, because a lot of times I think teams who are in that situation where they want to start out, they want to do this, they can't find someone who can do it.
Facebook.
Hello.
Hello,
Facebook. This next one is like almost metaphysical, and I'm
really
loving this. So basically, Arjo asks, let's say two teams work on two separate sprints in two places, but on the exact same problem.
Oh, wow. Will they win? Will they meet?
Would they come up with the same conclusions, number one? And the question behind it is it better to make two sprints with one team or make two sprints with two different teams?
Wow. Who is mine? Yeah,
this guy is stoned.
I know.
Arjo, you're stoned.
I wish you were here so we could ask follow up.
I think there's a reason why he didn't make it here. Hey.
Okay.
I love you, Arjo.
I mean, it is a good question. I actually recently talked to a team who ran 10 teams running sprints in parallel for 2 months. So we did 8 sprints. So 8 times 10, they did 80 sprints. And they had some teams working on the same problem. They did have some duplication. Like sometimes you have solutions that are similar. But that's why I kind of like to ask follow-up questions. Like, what advantage are you looking for? Like if you have a lot of people on your team and you have this pressing thing, like I would say have sprint teams basically compete on it. A principle of the sprints is like competition is good. It's good to have individuals compete with each other to come up with the best solution. It's good to have different solutions compete with each other in the test on Friday. And if you even have like different sprints in parallel, if you could do that, like awesome. And if you come up with the same solution, that's actually interesting. Because the disadvantage of doing it like one after the other is that you're going to come up with one solution that you feel good about after the first one. Even if the test doesn't go well, you're probably going to be on a path and kind of tend to head down that path. And with the idea that more competition is better, I would want to have more solutions. Like it'd be great to have those teams keep going in parallel and see where they ended up. Maybe they compare notes at some point, but yeah, it's weird. That's like a parallel universe thing. It's pretty cool.
Also, please tell him that whatever company can pay for that many sprints, call me.
he says, I'm in Berlin. Can't come if you want me to.
Whoa.
Set that up for tomorrow. That's good.
It seems like the idea for a sprint is you sort of know what you're going to do, but you have some specific questions about it or when and where we might fail along the way. Were there any cases where suddenly during the sprint figured out that, hey, are we even going the right way? So like imagine Blue Bottle Coffee in the middle of the sprint says, like, should we even be selling coffee online? Like, let's go into malls or like let's do some other stuff. So my point is like, is there a way to make sure that the teams really aligned on where they want to get them fully invested in testing specifics about it?
It's a really good question. I think that the time spent on Monday sharing information and making that map usually does a pretty good job of that, of saying like, where else could we be focused? Or like, what do we have to accomplish for this to work? What does this system sort of look like? And it's really basic stuff that it seems like teams would have already done, but I think in reality it's hard to do with everybody together without long enough period of time that you can really get into it and talk it through. I can certainly think of times when your teams will go through the sprint process and they will start to question some fundamental assumptions about strategy. You're usually going to see on Monday the team is going to have that moment of like questioning of like, where's the spot? It's a moment of like, where should we go? But once you pick that target, it's very unusual for there to be like a crisis of confidence mid-flight in the week. And then Friday, after you see the test, you might shake your foundation a little bit again in a good way. You know, I mean, in a way that you're learning. It'd be a very rare occasion when the CEO sort of like changed their mind partway through. When the troublemaker is also the CEO, that could be troubling. That's pretty uncommon. You know, if the CEO changes their own mind, like about the company strategy midweek, is pretty rare. Normally, you're going to make it from the beginning to the end of the week.
I see it as sometimes people also use the sprint to kind of get a buy-in from a bigger team.
Yeah.
About like, hey, let's participate in this together. Yeah. Let's do it, right? So maybe, you know, CEO doesn't have a very strong opinion about, hey, this is where you're going and shut up and just do it and everyone follows, right?
Yeah.
Versus like want everyone to be like kind of, you know, democratic about it. And hey, let's figure out a good way.
It works well to get buy-in. My definition of buy-in, it means like after it's over, people feel like we were a part of that. I'm not going to like a month from now be like, what the hell? Why are you doing that? Because they were there in the beginning and people feel more invested in an authentic way. They are invested. They were there at the beginning. You know, it's not that you're going to swindle. You're not going to trick everybody with your idea because the idea is going to be tested. There's all these sort of points where you're going to try to prove whether it works or not, whether other people on the team believe in it, whether it stands up to the information other people share, and then whether it stands up to the test. So it can build buy-in in a really, I think, good, authentic way. It's very hard to like use trickery in a sprint to influence others. One of the things it's meant to be is kind of a meritocracy.
Any hints and tips for people who are about to start facilitating that, especially in the context of so-called challenging participants or disengaged or disruptors in the negative way?
So like capture stuff on the whiteboard. When people say something, to say, okay, so what you're saying is, and then like write it down. And then like, is that right? And then like do that a lot. Like basically just like, is that okay? Wait, so you're saying, and then like write it down, because you take a lot of people's like gusto away when you do that. If they're like worked up about something or they want to like prove a point, if you just like, I'll write that down. There's not a lot left to say. And that doesn't always work, but that reduces a lot of troublemakerness because people normally, if they're just talking, they have to make their point stick verbally, they feel. And they feel that like, I have to keep talking about it or keep arguing it or keep going. And if you just like, okay, we'll write it down. And then you sometimes will have to say, okay, well, we've captured that, but so let's move on. You have to maybe like nudge them a little bit, but you've given them like this prize that they were after, which is your voice was heard. I think that can help a lot. And I don't mean to oversimplify it, because if you do have a difficult personality, sometimes you will have to tell them, like, it does come up where you have to be like, look, like, we got to keep moving. It's harder for me to do this because it is the process that I worked on. But like, you can blame the process. You can be like, because of the way the schedule works, we kind of have to keep going. And even I'll do that. Even if I made up the schedule, I'll be like, we have to keep going because of the schedule. It's the schedule. It's not you and me here. It's this darn schedule. And it's basically trying to like give them what they want in a way that doesn't take time, and then make it about time and not about you're right or wrong, you're smart, you're not smart, but just about like, okay, we'll just keep going. And then I think also it can be helpful to remind them of the story arc of the sprint, which is like, sounds like you've got a solution in mind, or you've got the beginnings of a solution in mind, or you have you're thinking a way to do this. What's going to happen next is you're going to have a chance. You know, that stuff usually happens on Monday, the lobbying, and sometimes on Wednesday. And in both cases, there's this thing coming up that's going to scratch that itch for you, or we're about to do a decision-making process or whatever. So if just because of the schedule, we got to move along and do it, but it'll happen. You'll have satisfaction.
I've actually started writing sentences down for the troublemakers. And one thing to say is that you guys should not worry so much about being right now, because the test itself is actually going to show you the direction you want to go in. So we even say to them, look, even if you would randomly throw the dot, if it would be throwable like that, like the decider dot at a random concept, even that being tested is going to show you a more clear way than not doing anything. So sometimes, I mean, just because we are also, of course, they've paid up front, and of course you have like these kind of CEO level people who might just kind of change their mind or might not trust the process. We keep saying that to them.
Yeah.
And that's why we actually stuck that up there. This getting started is more important than being right, is just to calm them down from worrying about making decisions that are final. We also keep saying to them, this is not a big commitment. You're committing 4 days. What's actually going to happen now is that you're putting very little time into a very big output, a very big learning, and that you shouldn't worry about this changing your entire company right now. So we end up like repeating constantly those things.
What you want out of the sprint is to learn about the thing, the service, whatever. But also what you want out of it is to start to change culture. So repeating that is also a way to just drive home to people. There's a different way of thinking about things. You can let go of that. I don't even think people who are being difficult like that like enjoy necessarily most of the time arguing. It's just that that's the way they have to get stuff done.
Yeah.
Or they feel that they have to get stuff done because the way that the team works is so not good. So if you like, even if it doesn't stick right away, you're giving him that like mantra of mindset shift.
Okay, my question is, how do you choose the right size problem? How do you not overcommit yourself to big a problem or to small one?
There's a few kind of built-in things that help with that a lot. There's one key thing, which is that if there's like no promising idea yet, if people want to feel like we just need to come up with what to do next, I'm worried. I'm worried about running a sprint in that situation. A sprint is not a way to come up with like your next million or billion dollar business idea. I don't believe that people come up with million or billion dollar business ideas following a set process. Maybe they do, but I feel like most business books that promise, here's the formula for success, you know, for successful business, are applying a formula that they made up backwards at examples that you look at whatever the most successful companies are. I don't believe that they followed some paper, like filling in spots on the paper, and then they were like, Airbnb, or like, you know, Ford Motor Company. It didn't like happen that way. And if you don't have like a good idea, if you don't have a good business idea somewhere in there, like the sprint's not going to provide it. That's way on like one end of like super open-ended, we need a business, you know, kind of thing. Sprint, I won't promise, is going to solve your problem there. Once you get past that, there's some built-in gates or like things that will basically protect most sprints from having a problem with this scope issue. The first problem is if it's not worth spending a week of time, if it's not a big enough deal that the people on the team who probably have a good sense of how to spend their time are willing to spend the time working on it, it's probably not the right size problem. So it probably is too small. And most too small problems won't pass that gate. You know, they won't get in there. And then the other thing is if it's a bit too big, actually, that's good. I mean, I think a big problem, as long as it's past like we have a business, a big problem is good because the strength of the sprint is it forces you to take a bite of it. And all problems, you have to start solving them somewhere. This is where it's like, it's helpful to have a process. So you don't have to think about the process. You can just start thinking about solving it. And then the sprint has all of these gates built in to help you take something really big and get something manageable. So the fact that you only choose one target customer type and the fact that you only choose one spot on the map, those are gates. So once you've done that, like it's really hard to have a scope that's way too big. And then the fact that you sketch three frames at a time and you're only going to choose like two or three of those solutions, that it also scopes down how much you're going to build and test. And the fact that you're going to have five customers, like you're not going to do this big, long, open-ended thing. You're just like all those things will take a big thing and like squeeze it down into something that is pretty well scoped. So that's the idea. And in practice, from what I've seen, that works pretty well as long as it's not too small. And you only get a too small problem with like an error in judgment. You know, if it takes you less than a week to just do the thing, like you should probably just do the thing. Most teams won't stop and do a sprint for that. If they do, then I can't help them.
We'll have to stop it now because we've run way over time than we actually wanted to go. Thanks so much, guys. Thanks for everyone for coming here, especially thanks, Jake, for taking the time out. I know we've already kind of blocked so much of your time this week.
No, really I was already nice. In the city, so thanks to all of you for coming.
Yeah, guys. Okay, so that was it. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm standing here in the kitchen of AJ and Smart because it's very loud here. Everyone's cleaning up and getting stuff ready for the Christmas break to close the office. So I'm hiding out here. It's a little bit lonely, but I kind of like it. I wish you a lovely 2018. I wish you a great time with your family, and I'm looking forward to having you back here ASAP. Bye-bye.